Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
I haven't ever brought in one of my career counseling clients on the show, but today I thought it might be instructive to do that. So let me introduce Dennis Bell. He was senior director of IT at Cypress Semiconductor, a major company, and then he wasn't. Dennis Bell, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty.
So,
go ahead.
What were you doing at Cypress, first of all, and how did you feel about your work?
Well, IT, information technology, and I was in charge of the data centers and worldwide network and all those computer things.
So data centers, what does that mean?
Large rooms with lots of humming boxes in them. All those things that run the web apps and things that make a company go.
Okay. And in 2007, they decided that although you're doing a lot of good things, for a variety of complex reasons that happened in corporate America, they decided they wanted to demote you, and so you left. At the risk of sounding corny, how did you actually feel? Were you relieved? Were you furious? Were you scared? What were you feeling at that point?
Well, I prefer to say that I worked myself out of a job than to say demotion.
Okay.
And maybe we can get back to stories in just a bit. How did I feel? Well, I felt kind of excited, and I was kind of relieved. After 7 years there, I had done what I'd set out to do, and it was time to move on, and I was excited about what I might be able to do.
And did you, some people when they let go, if they take a break, they went right, did you start right away and start looking for a job?
I started before I left Cypress. I started contacting my network, all those things, you know, calling people, emails, LinkedIn, and even responding to a few ads.
And how long did that go on, and did you have any successes, or did things work out poorly at that point?
I had no initial success. I had no intermediate success. I had no long-term success. It went on far longer than I ever thought.
How long?
Quarters. I was going to say months, but it went on quarters.
And so what was the first inflection point at that point? After number of quarters, what then happened?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, there were the practical issues. I didn't have income in that time, so I had to really address that, and I had a family to take care of. And there were the psychological things that were going on with me. I'd never been out of work. As an engineer early on, and then as an engineering manager, and then being in charge of IT shops, jobs had always come to me. So I didn't know how to handle it. I mean, psychologically, of course I was frustrated, but looking back on it, I was even a little bit depressed.
And so how long did that last? How bad did it get? Were you curled up with a bottle of vodka for 6 months in a row? What went on?
Well, thank goodness I'm not a drinker, but I did have my own distracting activities, and it took me a while to realize that they really were distracting activities. Finding a job, as you'll pointed out to me, is a job. And it did take me a while to figure that out.
What did you do while you were distracting yourself?
I'm a reader, so I read a lot of books. I mean, the library and I were buddies, and it was comfortable to go do something, at least get out of the house.
Yeah, you said you had a family support. I've found over the years that there are wives of two categories. There are those who say, you know, you got to get back on the horse. Hurry, you know, really pushing hard. You're the cash cow. Bring it in. And there are others who go on and take a job themselves to help out. What was your wife like in this situation?
We had difficulties. When I first had left Cypress, I was married at that point. And during the course of finding a job, which took a lot of time, I became unmarried. And I don't think this is all that unusual.
It's not.
I think you can probably tell me more about that. And of course, I mean, it was devastating. I mean, you're a guy. You're defined by what you do in work, and you're defined by your family. And that was a big, big
I found
problem.
That actually, you know, women would never admit it. they often do leave their husband for, at least in part, because he's no longer bringing home the bacon. So much for the love, until death do us part, and sickness and health, riches and poor. How much of why she left do you think was simply because you weren't bringing home the bacon?
Well, let's not go too far into who does what. The levee mm-hmm. and the leaver isn't what it really it's about. Mm-hmm. Bringing home the bacon is a big part of the identity. And I think in our case, it showed the fissures that were already there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because like many people, I had kind of gotten myself into a workaholic mode. Cypress is one of those companies where you can do
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of papered over those things.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it showed up things that were already there.
So when was the first positive thing? What got you out of the depression that came from both losing the job, losing the wife, and just feeling your identity threatened?
Finding work.
What did you do to find the work?
I got some consulting through one of my networking contacts, a former colleague at Cypress. I called him up. He was in Minnesota. I said, well, does it make sense to be calling people in Minnesota, and here I am in California? In that case, it did, because he had a friend mm-hmm. back in California who had a need. This friend of mine knew that I could do that kind of thing. He hooked us up, and I got some part-time consulting.
Now, was this one of the contacts you had made early on that simply took a long time to emerge as valuable? Or, despite the depression, was this one of the contacts you made even while you were depressed?
It was the latter. It was kind of my secondary list. We all have mm-hmm. a top list, and mm-hmm. I was working my way through. And I called up Jim, and I said, you know, this is what's going on. And he mentioned this opportunity, and I called this gentleman, and we met, and he had an immediate need, something I could do, and it was great. It was great to get some work.
How long did it take? You know, these days you're hearing ever more about it takes 4 or 5 months even to get a consulting assignment with all these stupid interviewing processes. Was this something that happened quickly, or was it an enduring process?
This happened quite quickly, mm. and that's the interesting thing, is that I do have many colleagues and friends, like you talk about. They say, well, I interviewed with this company, and I interviewed with this first person, and there was questions that came back, and then I had other interviews, and then there's the team interviews, and like you say, it goes on for months. When it comes to an individual, in this case, he was a single-person shop,
mm.
the decision was immediate.
Got it. Great. So, of course, you know, you're back in the saddle, and that's going to make you... There's no way to become less... If your depression is caused by lack of work, there's no better cure than work to cure the depression. But that was a consulting assignment. What happened next that's useful for our listeners to hear?
Well, a follow-on. I mean, that's the thing about being a consultant. You're always selling. Mm. And this is kind of one of my learnings through this whole time. As I mentioned, I'm an engineer. I had not realized how important selling my mm. capabilities and continuing value would be. So I got more consulting assignments from the same gentleman.
Mm.
And that was helpful. It was part-time still, but it allowed me to say I was working. By golly, right. that makes a giant
mm-hmm.
difference. When
mm-hmm.
you go back out and you can re-engage your own network and say, well, you know, I've picked up this gig mm-hmm. and I'm doing this now. Just to let you know, I'm still looking for people who might need what I can do.
Mm-hmm. There's many flavors of selling. You said you had to learn how to sell. What's one thing you learned about selling that has been effective for you?
This sounds like a shibboleth, but it's true. Be myself.
Mm. What is yourself?
Well, I'm thoughtful. I'm a planner. I can seem like not much is happening, and then I will say the right thing at the right time. I'm not an in-your-face guy. I'm not a salesman. So I sell through capability, and I sell through listening.
Something we've talked about in our sessions, you know, you're a Midwesterner, and that all that implies in terms of, you know, not being too aggressive, being, you know, more reflective than impulsive, and that's going to work for certain people and not work for others.
Well, and that's the other secret to sales, and it took me a long time to get past that, being able to determine and handle no.
Mm.
A lot of what do I mean by determine no? A lot of people won't tell you no.
That's right. Not
they just won't.
Rejection, ignoring is the new no.
Exactly right. So you have to decide when to cut and go do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is I needed to learn how to handle no.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always been used to doing a good job and being able to meet people's needs. it's really hard to handle nine no's to get the 10th. Yes.
It is a different world. I've been doing this career counseling thing for 26 years. I have never seen as much difficulty in landing a job as in the last 3 to 4. Absolutely. Not even close. They talk about a recovery. It's a jobless recovery. Most of the jobs that are hired are part-time, temp, crappy paying, last 2 months. You know, yeah, if you're an absolute superstar, you can still get great work. But for normal, perfectly good human beings, it ain't easy anymore.
Well, I do want to hit that. Handling the no is really, really important. And it's a psychological thing. Mm-hmm. First, I had to acknowledge that I felt bad.
Sure.
And not pretend that it was okay.
Mm.
And then reach out and get some help.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. Today I've tried something brand new. I've never brought in one of my career counseling clients, but I thought maybe it would be instructive instead of having some big expert come in, just have a regular person from the, you know, who's actually doing it right now. The story is not over yet. The movie hasn't ended. We're just really ending act one. Anyway, my guest is Dennis Bell. He was a senior director at Cypress Semiconductor, and then he wasn't. And we're walking through the travails, the good, the bad, and the ambiguous. So, okay, let's go from there. So you've had a couple of consulting assignments. And these were like of the few month variety kind of thing?
Right. It went on for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I continued to find a job mostly responding to ads.
That's very interesting. The old conventional wisdom was that that networking was the best way to land a job. And it's probably still true, but in an era where there is tremendous concern about not wanting to be racist, sexist, etc., there's legal mandates to have very broad searches so that more of the jobs are filled not through the back door but openly. But the challenge of that, of course, is because it's so easy to access job openings. There's usually dozens or hundreds of applicants for each job. But yes, I think the old thing that you really should ignore the ads and network, I think needs a little more nuance these days. You need to balance both the networking, cold contact with strange employers, people you don't know, as well as ads. And if you are employed already and well-employed, then yes, headhunters can help. Does that comport with your feelings right now?
It does. And indeed, I got responses to my applications. With help, I got better at spiffing up my cover letters in particular. I started getting telephone call interviews. They went better than I had hoped. And in the past, they went better. And we can talk more about that and how I improved my speaking ability on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I got interviews, and indeed I became finalist in 3 different jobs.
What did you learn about cover letters? What have you learned? What would be different in a cover letter you'd write today than one you would write when you first started your job search?
The cover letter ostensibly is about me, but it's really about them. It's about really picking up on the need of the job, reading between the lines where necessary, but in fact, in many cases, reading explicitly the words that they have, putting them down and saying how you can meet that need. They are looking for somebody who can hit the ground running, as I used to say, and really is exactly responsive to the needs. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
And be willing to inject something personable to be memorable.
That's something we did talk about. Especially people who are in the hard sciences or in engineering or technology, rationally they correctly point out that in an ideal world, it would simply be your chops. What is your ability? How reliable you are? End of story. But in reality, in a tough job market, when there are so many people applying, that what differentiates the winning candidate from some other very good candidates is this emotion thing. You said you've told me that was one of the things that you've learned from our work together. What have you learned about emotion? How do you go about trying to incorporate it in your job search and in your life?
Be willing to express emotion. And that's appropriate. It's appropriate to each setting. Be willing to use feel language. I'm excited about this job. This opportunity keeps me awake at night. You know, why not? What is it that you have to lose other than, of course, being told no, as we talked about earlier? But you have a chance to connect up with people, and it's that connection that can make that next interview happen.
My opinion is that emotion is actually best when it is mainly positive but also mentioning some negatives. Because the job applicant who's always excited and happy and upbeat and chipper and all those things feels as a little disingenuous. But for somebody to say, you know, I'm a little scared that this job might not be such a good fit. You know, I've got this background, but I'm a little lacking here. Or, you know, it seems like your business plan isn't quite as solid as it should be, and I'm worried that maybe this might be chaotic to straighten me out. You know, so talking about some negatives, America is the land of positivism, so no, it can't even be 50-50. But if the emotions that you convey are three quarters positive and roughly one quarter negative, that seems in general, of course, it's going to vary with the situation, but that seems in general most likely to both enhance your credibility as well as show the humanity that is in you. What's your reaction to that?
That worked for me. A job, and we can talk about that in a bit, that I'm working right now, I think during the interview process, when I expressed a reservation, did my technology knowledge meet their current needs? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I said, I didn't think it did. Mm-hmm. And technology is like day-old bread. It gets stale, and you have to refresh it. And I said I was worried about that. And I also said what I was doing to come back up to speed. And I think that's an important mm-hmm. part of what you're saying, is if you can express a worry like that, then add to it, well, what you're doing about it to show that you're, as they say, proactive. I think that worked.
And, of course, an important side benefit is if you really don't have the chops to do the job, it's better to ignore, you know, then it's not the right job for you. You're going to have a failure, and it's going to be bad for the company and bad for everybody. So, it's, you know, candor is the ingredient that has often been most leached from the job interview process, both from the employer's perspective and the employee's. And I think it's the factor that both is most pragmatically likely to help you get a good fit job and is also, of course, you know, right for the world. What was the next major thing that occurred? So you had a couple of these consulting assignments, then what?
I decided to start my own business.
Right. Tell us about that.
I've had it said to me that everybody ought to start at least one business in their working lifetime, mm-hmm. and I went ahead and did it. It was exciting, and it was disastrous.
Tell me a little more about it.
Well, the exciting part is I had a chance to put into actuality something that I'd thought about for a long time, but we don't have to go into it. It was in the solar field. I'd worked in that early in my career, had some ideas, and I said, this is the time to try it. I had some money from my Cyprus work years, and I decided to start a business and try it out.
Mm-hmm. And now solar, you know, this was a few years ago, you know, at that point, solar was viewed as the holy grail, the most exciting thing. When Barack Obama was first elected, the price of the solar stock index was 1,700, an all-time high. And yet, it wasn't exactly a stellar success. How come?
Well, I got beat, as many did, by low-cost manufacturing. When I came in, solar panels were at a pretty high price, and they dropped down to, let me do a calculation here, to 20%. Of what it was when I started.
Absolutely. The solar stock index went from 1,700 is now 180. It went down as low as 80. Yep.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, I had some technology which I thought was pretty good, but it simply couldn't compete. And I found that out late. The only good news is I didn't waste any taxpayer money doing it.
Did you find that you really, you know, it's very easy to blame externalities, you know, the market, the Chinese, this, that. How much of it, if you're looking in your soul, was that you just weren't a savvy enough business guy who understood where the likely best risk-reward ratio was and how much was simply external things?
It's marketing, and I failed at marketing. Hmm. I know companies now that are still succeeding in the solar market. They're not making panels. They're making other things. And if I had my marketing together, and that means talking with real customers, mm-hmm. and finding out what real needs are, I think I could have made a better go of it.
Not so much marketing, but product identification. I mean, that's before you get to marketing. It's really figuring out where the unmet need is, where there is going to be, where you have an edge in finding and sourcing or developing the product, and then getting to market quickly.
All of that. As I've done my reading, and I told you I like libraries, almost every business has a series of failures before they succeed. And that's the second thing. I didn't have the staying power. I didn't have enough funds to stay through several failures. And so in combination, find out real needs and have the money to be able to try out multiple things.
You said twice now that you like libraries. That reminds me, you're 50-plus. It's axiomatic in this world, especially in the world of technology, that notwithstanding laws prohibiting age discrimination, there is certainly a belief that younger people are more up to speed, willing to work harder, have better memories, better energy, all the rest of it. What have you experienced being a guy 50-plus in looking for work?
I've run up against ageism. I've had potential employers tell me that I was too experienced.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is that but a keyword?
Not necessarily. It could mean that, you know, they figure you're so overqualified you're going to be bored and you're going to leave in 2 weeks. Not the chronological age. Am I wrong?
That's a possibility. But in this case, the job wasn't really that way.
What do you do to try to – what have you done? I mean, I've talked on the radio ad nauseum about – you know, ways to address ageism, basically by being preemptive, talking about it as a strength in cover letters and interviews. But what has Dennis Bell done internally, psychologically, to deal with the conventional popular wisdom that if you're over 40, you're washed up, especially in IT? And what have you done externally to try to convince others you're not washed up over 50?
Appearances count. Appearances count.
Mm-hmm.
I got myself a new wardrobe. Talk to your wife, talk to your girlfriend. She'll let you know.
No plastic surgery, though.
No.
But you know how many people do, you know, these days, from Botox on to full facelifts and stuff like that, because we do. And it's interesting. I really think that guys are losing an opportunity. It somehow seems unmasculine to get plastic surgery. And I'm not doing it for cosmetic reasons, but the reality is from a jaw, I've not had plastic surgery. But if I were a job seeker and I was a typical person over 50, was getting wrinkly and jowly and old looking and tired and my eyes were looking tired and all the rest of it, I would not be averse and I would not want to be judged on that. And I would not be averse to considering cosmetic surgery because I have seen people before and after and they do look 10 years younger. And what's your opinion about that?
Looking younger is good. So.
Thank you for your professional judgment on that. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko, my sartorial expert on looking with profound statements. Looking young is good is Dennis Bell. Why? How is he qualified to do that? He has no qualifications whatsoever. He was senior director of IT at Semiconductor, lost his job, and he's talking about what he's done and lessons learned about how to try and find work since then. Let's go to a different topic. So, what have you, after those consulting gigs, what was the next key moment in your career trajectory?
Well, I mentioned it earlier. I decided I needed help. I wasn't making progress in getting the jobs I wanted. Of course, as you mentioned earlier, I sought you out. I talked with many different friends. And indeed, I joined an organization called Toastmasters to help my speaking ability.
That was great group.
Of immeasurable help.
Right. How did Toastmasters, other than the obvious you learn to speak better, how did Toastmasters benefit you?
I learned to listen better.
Mm.
A big part of that experience is evaluating others, and you have to become a better listener. I found that I had not really been attending to people.
Mm. Yeah, and it's not everybody thinks they're a good listener, and they're not. It's really hard. It's really hard to stay really paying attention, not only to what's said, but what's not said, the feelings, everything, and not just be narcissistic.
A good interview involves a true conversation. The other person really has to be heard.
Yep.
And appropriately answered. You say appropriately, well, of course you have to inject your story. Of course you have to tell them how you can meet their needs. And they have to feel like you have connected to them as a person and to the need that they're presenting. I found that ostensibly Toastmasters is for group communications. I found it really improved my interpersonal communication.
Very interesting. You also mentioned that you would join this ProMatch organization. What's one important thing that's not obvious that you learned from ProMatch, which is basically a group of job seekers that's sponsored by the government?
Well, it's something we kind of touched on earlier about appearances.
Hmm.
They taught me that a person makes an impression on you, in the first second that they meet you.
That's correct.
And not only that, the rest of the time, whether it's a phone call or interview, they are confirming that impression.
Absolutely. And it's not just physical. I really believe that I can judge a person's IQ within 5 seconds, 10 seconds. You can just tell the nature of their vocabulary, the complexity of their thought. You can learn maybe 5 to 10 seconds is pushing it, but certainly within a minute of interchange, right, listening to them and having them listen to me and seeing, I can, within 5 to 10 points, I can pinpoint their IQ, and I'm pretty sure. So, yes, those first impressions are critical. You do need to be on your A game.
We talked about appearances earlier, and a big part of appearances is your demeanor. Are you standing straight? Are you mm-hmm. sitting straight?
Yep.
Are you bright-eyed, wide-eyed?
Exactly.
All of these things are demeanor kinds of things, and doing that can take 10 years off your age,
It's
too.
Terrible that we are so shallow that we judge crap. It was Helen Gurley Brown, the founder of Cosmopolitan magazine, who said, after 40, it all comes down to posture.
I get it.
Yeah, I get it too, alas. Anyway, you've had a bigger win. We're running out of time, so let's get to... You've had a bigger win recently. You now work for Comstrat. You help colleges and school districts improve their IT infrastructure. How did you land that job?
I got connected with Communication Strategies, that's their full name, through a friend. So networking does work.
Yeah.
And it was a recontact with that friend, a coffee. Getting in front of your network is really
coffee
important.
Coffee rather than the cloud. Getting together for coffee is still, and I love technology. I'm no technophobe, but in the end, if I had to look at my 4,000 clients, more of them got jobs through coffee than through internet connects, through LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, etc.
Absolutely. And she joined up with a small company, Comstrat, and said, they're looking to add one or two key people. You might fit the bill. Send me your resume. So I spiffed up my resume a little bit, sent it along.
What did you change to make it more winning?
The first few words. The resumes that people look at, they do not read every word for 2 pages.
Same thing, first impression.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I made it, as best I could, targeted to their needs.
Do you remember what it said, the first few words? You know, you probably, that's ridiculous. Me, yeah.
Sorry, Marty.
No problem. Superstar was the first word, right? Amazing. Right, no. Okay. So, great. So now you've gotten this job. And tell us what the job is. And most importantly, what's one lesson you've learned about working that would make you more likely to keep your job or get promoted at Comstrat rather than be where they'd want to let you go?
It is IT consulting. And what I learned is that companies are reducing their IT staff and using more outside consultants. So I finally got smart and I followed that trend. And now I'm working on the consulting side. Great. What did I learn? Judgment matters. I was and am drinking through a fire hose on the technology side. And I have to make judgments as to where I put my scarce time. And I'm always having to ask myself, is what I'm doing right now the most important thing I can be doing? And I do that multiple times through the day, and it helps.
Yeah. It's a term I use is time effectiveness. We're not looking for, we're saying, where are you going to get the best benefit for the time expended in terms of what's important for your boss, what's important to you, and what's important cosmically?
All of those things are true. The customers are expecting that you're going to know well enough to advise them. They don't expect you to know everything. Customers are not crazy that way, but they expect you to know well enough to advise them correctly.
I'm a big fan. We can't preemptively anticipate all client needs. So what I recommend to clients in general is some of my clients fail because they feel the need to have all their ducks in a row in advance. I encourage you rather to get the basics that you need. And then if a client or anybody else asks you for knowledge that you don't have, you say, that is really good. I want to give you a really solid answer. I'll get back to you tomorrow. And then you can do just-in-time learning and really do the deep dive rather than trying to guess in advance where the need is. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. Indeed, they taught me that at Cypress Semiconductor. Be willing to say, I don't know right now, and then give, as you just said, a time when you can get back to them. It's almost always acceptable.
Last question. I want to just ask you an open-ended softball. So we've covered the full travail of your going from respected senior director at Cypher Semiconductor, a Fortune 1000 company, to unemployed, to depressed, to consulting jobs, to your networking, to landing a job now. What's one thing that our listeners should hear from you that is not obvious that you haven't yet said?
Schedule fun. It sounds strange.
Mm-hmm.
Fun is different than sloth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just as you schedule your job finding activities, schedule time with your friends and family for special fun times. They don't have to be costly. And then go have fun. Put all of your energy in that, and when it's done, come back.
And I'd add one thing that you could also keeping in mind while you want to keep in mind time effectiveness. You also should be asking yourself at every step of the way in your work, is there a more fun way to do this? You know, if I enjoy talking on the phone, and I do, I would call do more phone work. If I enjoyed more, I like writing, I'm going to write. If I hate spreadsheets, I'm going to figure out a way how I can minimize that stuff. Figuring out the most fun way to do it. That's what I think. I still want to give you the last word. One more thing that you want to share with our listeners, and then I'm going to say goodbye.
Oh, my goodness, Marty. It's been great on being on your show today. I've never done a radio show.
You did great.
So to your audience, be willing to do something new.
Mm, that's great. Well, very much. I much appreciate your being on the show, Dennis Bell. I wish you great luck at Comstrat and everything else. And if I can mention your wonderful new girlfriend, Cheryl, I hope you're wishing the two of you all the best.
Thank you, Marty.
Okay. And now, my dear listeners, it is now time for you. We do, usually in the second half of the show, what we primarily devote our attention to is doing what I call three-minute workovers. If you or someone you love is stuck, either unemployed or very well employed but still unhappy, or has a problem with a coworker, a supervisor, or an employee, you're running a business, you want to run a business idea by me, anything related to your work, even on the personal side, we all know that our ability to do well at work is not just a function of our skills, but our psychological well-being, sometimes our relationships. So anything related to work directly or indirectly, I do what are called three-minute workovers, where you call and you tell me a situation, and I try to help you take at least a baby step forward, if not a large one. And this is the time to call before the lines get all packed. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for a three-minute workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, I have the honor tomorrow to be doing a 2.5-hour workshop at the National Conference for the 46,000 member Society for Neuroscience. These are the PhD researchers and professors in brain research. And I've been working hard, of course, for this during this week to try to prepare for it. And there are some, I just finished creating the handout, and there's some of the items on this that I think would be relevant to you. I'm assuming you're not in neuroscience, but these are relevant. And the first section of my workshop is going to be called direction, and choosing your direction, creating, seeing how much you want to pivot. And while you may have heard these words before, I think it's really useful. I'm well aware that most companies and organizations have mission statements that are BS, that are absolutely useless. They're just a bunch of, you know, pontificating ideals that they don't end up following. But I think that it is more likely to be of value when you develop a personal mission statement, one for yourself. And the best way for me to introduce that is to share mine with you. My personal mission statement is to use my best skills, that is writing and speaking, to abet capable people's careers, to improve education for the intellectually gifted, and to support efforts to increase understanding of the biological basis of intelligence. That is my personal mission statement. What are the key ingredients in that? Number one, I've identified the best skill or two that I use, and I've identified what is the goal or two that I most want to direct it toward. And note that I've picked things that are not common and popular. I have a number of conventional popular beliefs. For example, I am very pro-choice and I am very pro-gay marriage. But there are so many billions of dollars and so many people, and the media is all behind pro-choice and pro-gay marriage, that for me, that my additional value that I would add to those enterprises is near zero. It'd be like adding a grain of sand on a large beach. Whereas Nobody these days, we're in an era of egalitarianism where the focus is on the least among us, among the handicapped, the poor, any group that is perceived, people in Africa, anybody who is perceived as a have not. And therefore, there is not a lot of interest in the intellectually gifted or the biological basis of intelligence. Even the word intelligence is considered controversial. We used to call it cognitive functioning, reasoning, learning ability, skills. The word intelligence is anathema. And yet we all know in our heart of hearts that the ability to learn quickly, reason abstractly, remember a lot, that is critical to almost all pursuits. So I've chosen to focus my discretionary time and money, frankly, I just set up a prize for the best doctoral dissertation in this area through the Society for Neuroscience. I've chosen something deliberately that is unpopular because I'm much more likely to make some difference if I'm not merely a grain of sand on the beach. So anyway, that is my personal mission statement, merging my best skills and abilities with the goals that I want to use those skills and abilities toward, and focusing on that which is not popular. So, my dear listeners, I invite you right now to take a few seconds. I can't leave silence on the radio because it's just, you'll think that we have dead air, we have a problem with technology problem. But I invite you certainly to take a minute or two now while you're listening or after the show is over to write down what are your best skill or two? What is the goal or two that you would most like to apply those skills to, and especially give priority to something that is not the conventional wisdom. Like 90% of the Bay Area is environmentalist. For you to say to improve the environment, your chances are pretty darn small of really moving the needle at all. So think of something you believe in that is not so widely held, especially here in the Bay Area. Okay, now we got callers on the line. So before I share some more ideas of what I'm going to be talking about at that Society for Neuroscience conference, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? It's you. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. What gives me the honor of the call?
Oh, well, I was listening to the radio, and I have a younger brother who's just, graduated from college, and he's having a really tough time transitioning his internship experience into a full-time job.
Right.
And he's pretty depressed about it,
right.
And I feel really bad for him because I think this is his first, real go at getting a full-time job, and it's just not working out the way he wants it. But he's shutting down, and I think just as his immediate family, we're having trouble supporting him and comforting him. And so I thought I'd call and just ask if, someone who's in their early career doesn't really know the hard knocks of it, what can we as people who are in the job force who want to support him but don't want to keep telling him what to do?
Right. Okay. Well, great. First of all, we need to start with a bit of reassurance. It's not that he's a loser. Here, I just read this. The Pew Charitable Trusts have just come out with a study that found that 36% of all millennials are living back at home with their parents, and one-third are unemployed. This is, as I said earlier in the show, in my 26 years of being a career counselor, the last 3 years have been by far the worst in helping people land jobs. So he first needs to recognize that his problem, at least in part, is a problem that's much bigger than him. But having said that, just as my guest Dennis Bell found that what uplifted him from his depression was work, because he was depressed because of a lack of work and therefore a lack of identity. Ultimately, what's going to lift this young man out of his malaise is work, even if it is short-term, part-time, temp, not the greatest job in the world. So, but I don't want him flipping burgers. We want to get him the best job we can, but even if it were some crapola job at a McDonald's, I'd rather see him do that than sit at home where he's more likely to just get stoned, watch video games, and objects at rest tend to stay at rest. Objects in motion tend to stay in motion. So let's start by trying to learn a little bit about him, and let's find a really great job target for him that could get him juiced up and trying to go and get that job. So tell me a little bit of the key things about him, and let's see what we can come up with.
Okay, well, he is interested in the entertainment industry. He's had some really great internships with well-known companies, but you know, as it is, the entertainment industry is by far someone you have to know someone to get into. And we're just, that's not where most of our family is
right.
in.
Yeah. Entertainment and the environment, those are the two industries that are the most difficult to get into right now. Continue.
Right. So he has, you know, he has basic office administration skills. He has, you know, production skills. But as you were saying, you know, and I absolutely agree with you, but I think what's been hard for him is that, unfortunately, he's the youngest in the family. He has a little bit of an ego, and I think he's landed most of his internships without really having to work too hard for them. So he's done a little, you know, production work during the summer, and then I think he feels that it's really insecure, and he really
sure it is.
Has motivation in his head that I want to have a secure job, I want a full-time job, and so he doesn't see the value of doing the little contract work here and there to meet more people. And
well, here's what's going on in my little head.
Okay.
When somebody's had a few internships at prestigious companies implies that, I mean, these are companies that have money and they do hire some of those interns. I've told this story on the radio before, but it's so potent that I need to do it. It's totally relevant here. I was on the Today Show, and when I showed up at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York, there were like 30 interns, and they all looked exactly the same. They were all women who were in their 20s, gorgeous, size zero or double zero, wearing pencil skirts and perfect expensive shoes. But they were all kind of just standing around, mainly chatting with each other. Sure, they say, oh, would you like coffee? Da, 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 da. They were flirting, the whole deal. But there was one, and it was a woman who was racing around trying to help everybody. The cameraman, what can I do? And she was not just an intern, but she went to us and, you know, can I answer some questions about the show, tell you about the format of the, you know, what the interviewer's like. That she was fabulous. At the end of my interview, I go to her and I say, you know, you really impressed me. She says, thank you very much. Of the 30 interns, they only gave one or two job offers. I just got a job offer. I'll be working for NBC after my internship is over. So I'm wondering, this kid has gotten a couple of internships at premier places. You say he's kind of got an entitlement mentality. I'm wondering whether he was one of those interns who was really kind of, instead of treating that as an audition, as an opportunity to show that he's better than the other interns and that he's worthy of a job, did he have a chip on his shoulder and say, Jesus, I went to college to learn, you know, to get coffee? What is part of the problem that, and should he get another internship or entry-level job, but with a completely different attitude, that it's an audition, it's showtime, and that if he does well, there's no guarantees, but especially if he gets out of the damn entertainment industry where there's 10 zillion wannabes, but if he gets into another industry, another field or a nonprofit or whatever, that if he really just says, this is showtime, and I'm going to audition and I'm going to bust their butts, I'm going to be amazing, is that really the logical next step, even if it's on a volunteer basis, to beat the inertia as well as give him the attitude he needs to succeed?
Well, I think everyone who was in his support group would agree with you that, you know, go kick butt wherever you are. I mean, he did get called back at one of his internships, and he was one of two finalists, and unfortunately, he didn't get it. But I think the problem we're seeing within the family is that he used to be someone that was really reliable, and we had no problem, you know, recommending him to our network. But I think because he's been so down that he's been flaking, which is so unlike him. And so it's really hard for us to be able to communicate him the value of being a great employee at any place, wherever it may be in whatever industry. So we can't seem to get him to budge, you know, as you're saying. It's not productive to sit at home and, you know, try to watch your emails and see if something comes in.
Right.
You know, it's hard to convince him, you know, it's about going out there and pressing the flesh and, you know, getting business cards and being in front of people.
What I would do is this, with a kid like that, sometimes, you know, I know he's a grown-up, but I swear, if he were my son, I realize that I'm not going to beat the inertia with more lecturing, as you said. It hasn't worked. I would work with him to come up with a goal, and we would get in our car, my car, and I would drive him from place to place and get him walking in and giving his sales pitch to the admin or whoever's at the door for any businesses that might be a good place for him to start. And I'd be sitting in the car and letting him keep doing the song and dance. And then we would giggle. We would have a good time. We'd go out to lunch. We'd do whatever. But I would get his butt into as many workplaces as I can and would not expect him to do it by himself, because right now he's spiraling down. That would be, I'm from European parents. And European parents are much more, they don't believe that when a kid is 18, he's on his own, end of story. They believe that you have a responsibility, you know, without disempowering the kid, you push that kid until he's in the right place. Is that too controlling? I know it's non-American to be that controlling. What's your reaction to that?
No, my parents are Asian. They're very controlling. I actually would take time out of my day. I would fly down to where he lives and do exactly what he told me. Because, like you said, we've given him that lecture. I told him exactly some of the points you've been saying in September. And I can honestly probably say that he's done 10% of it. So it's really hard for me to continue telling him what to do when I think he's kind of just ignoring the advice.
There's a multi-generational, there's a natural tendency among many people to rebel against their parents merely because their parents are telling them. But since you mentioned that you were Asian, so was this woman who was the intern at the Today Show. She was one of the only, maybe the only Asian women among the 30. There were a lot of whites and blacks and Latinos. She was the only Asian, and she was the one who got hired because she had this tremendous drive. She knew she had almost an obligation, maybe I'm overgeneralizing, obligation to herself, to her family, to her culture, to whatever. She felt this cosmic obligation to work hard at whatever she did. And I would bet you that if she was at a shoeshine stand, she would work hard and fast and try to give the best damn shoeshine. And I'm wondering whether talking to him, I mean, we all are a function of our culture. And the Asians have a tremendous amount to be proud of. They work so hard. As immigrants, as new immigrants, they've done amazing things in this country. Is it maybe, you know, like we tell other ethnic groups, we say, I'm black, I'm proud, be proud of your ethnicity. Would it help to invoke the amazing tradition of what Asians have contributed to the society, that he is a part of that tradition and he is honor-bound to live up to that tradition, or is that pushing it too hard?
You know, it's really interesting because my parents and his uncle, they are the immigrant generation. They came here, they're entrepreneurs, they worked really hard. And I'm 12 years older than my brother, so you could say there's a bit of, you know, a generational gap between the two of us. And I told him, there is no job that is below you.
Right.
And so I told him, go to our uncle, go get a desk job or
right.
be a delivery boy, whatever. But unfortunately, the message that came out of my uncle was, no, just hang on, you'll get what you want. And so in their minds, they feel like they came to the United States, they worked their butt off, they don't want to see their, you know, offspring have to go through the same struggle.
But that is
but
what works.
That's a really interesting response from that mm-hmm. generation. Whereas I'm totally against that. I think go get a job at McDonald's or Starbucks part time and, you know, make yourself useful and at least get a paycheck. And it's just, I think he's resting on his laurels a little bit and being a little bit conceited.
Yeah. You develop a respect for the sacredness of work from having any low-level job. My first job was filling out garnishee notices for a credit furniture store in Harlem. It was as low-level, it was soulless, it was complete paperwork, but I felt, it made me feel that all work was important. My father, when he came to this country, no job was beneath. He sewed shirts in a factory in Harlem. And he didn't stay there. He learned and valued work. He ended up selling shirts out of a cardboard box on the streets of Harlem, the shirts he had sewed. And then he saved up for the, you know, once then he learned a little bit about the clothing business, he opened a little tiny store. All work, like we said, objects at rest tend to stay at rest. Objects don't go from 0 to 60 in 1 second. They go from 0 to 60 in 10 or 20 seconds. And therefore, he's not going to stop spiraling down without starting something simple and small. All work is honorable work. He must realize that. I have a PhD, and I swear on my life, if I had to, in order to make, even not to make a living, even if I had money, if I had a choice of being just sitting and watching TV or shining people's shoes, I would shine the shoes, because the shoes are making a difference. They are being productive. He must realize that, if at all possible. And if he doesn't realize it, I would fly down. Maybe one of the greatest acts you could do in your life is to take that very bold and dramatic action to get on a plane and say, you are in trouble, and I am getting on a plane to save you, because right now you are at the risk of going down the drain. Because if we wait 3 or 4 more years and your resume shows you doing nothing, then even if the economy turns around and you try to get a job, they're going to say, well, what have you been doing? Uh-oh, are you really going to be able to compete with those other people who have been working in the interim? I think flying down may be required.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah,
all right.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Let's go back to the phones. I was going to be talking about the... actually, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to intersperse between calls. I'm going to share some of these things that I've been working on for this presentation I'm making tomorrow at the Society for Neuroscience National Conference. It's my conference that... The workshop is called Actively Managing Your Career in Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School. One of the things I'm going to have him do, and again, one of the nice things about going to a conference is you get to step out of your life and step back and do some reflection. So I, on their handout, I ask, how many degrees of pivot should you make regarding each of the following? In other words, do you need no change, 0 degrees, a minor change, which would be like 15 or 30 degrees, a moderate change, which might be 45, 180 would be a radical change. So why don't you think about it yourselves, guys, my dear listeners. How many degrees of pivot should you make regarding your career? Regarding, and this is for scientists, so forgive me, your research agenda, your proposal writing, again, academics write a lot of proposals, your teaching, your advising, your service, community service, that could be relevant to anybody, your professional development, your learning, your relationships, your avocations. How many degrees pivot should you make regarding any of those? And what's the nature of the pivot? Think about it now. Think about it after the show. One more. And this is, again, not new, but very, very helpful. Efficiency has developed a dirty, it seems like a dirty word somehow. We can call it time effective or whatever, good time management, but efficiency is almost evokes a term like Nazi. You know, the Nazis were highly efficient. And as a child of Holocaust survivors, nobody could be more sensitive to the Nazis, but I think efficiency is a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing. It's making the most of the one commodity we have so little of, which is time. So one way to get a sense, to step back and get a sense of how well you're using time, is to create a grid. So I'd like you right now, take a piece of paper, and on the top put the days of the week. And on the left side, going down the left side, each hour that you're awake. So if you wake 8 a.m., you know, you start at 8, you know, and then go 9, 10, you know, all the way till you go to sleep. And then for each hour, hour by hour, you don't have to be obsessive about it, just write down what you do during, like in a typical week or whatever, what do you do during that time period? And then look at, you won't do it now, enough time to do it now, but look at that week and then ask yourself, do you want to make any changes? Just a simple little exercise that can be helpful. Do you want to do anything more? You want to do anything more of something, less of something? One more, and then I'll go to the phones. It's obvious that you generally can do most tasks better by yourself than if you delegate to somebody for 10 or 15 bucks an hour. But the question is the opportunity cost, what you otherwise could be doing with your time, worth doing it yourself? Right. So, you know, sometimes it's not just in terms of money. You know, maybe you want to spend time with your girlfriend Cheryl or whatever. Maybe you want to spend time writing a play for the fun of it. Or maybe you do want to spend more time on something that's going to earn more money. But the question is, ask yourself, as you think about the tasks that you do, would it be wiser to get as a personal assistant, an intern, or in the case of these professors that I'm talking to, a graduate student to do some more of that work to free you up to do other stuff? Okay, now I'll go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm dealing with both the issues of being an over 50 worker and also the pivot question.
Mm-hmm.
I've called your show before for various things, and you've always been very helpful. I'm in a job where I've been for a few years, and I've had some really good achievements, and this is after kind of clawing my way back into the workforce after, for several weeks, taking too much time off after having my child, and then finding that I was a dinosaur when I tried to return and going back to school to improve my computer and workplace skills.
Right.
I found myself with a fairly decent job in a government agency.
Mm-hmm.
And really enjoying a lot of what I'm doing and having a good personal relationship with my boss. But the past couple of years, occasionally I have just dropped some balls and made some mistakes.
Okay.
And she has indicated to me that she's just about had it with that aspect of my performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I'd like to do is offer to put in for a transfer to a different department. And also, you know, look for a different job. But, you know, they say wherever you go, there you are.
Question. What is the area that you've been screwing up with?
What they call attention to detail.
Okay.
I called your show once in the show about guilt at work because I had I'd forgotten to take the time difference of an East Coast.
Yeah, I remember you. Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah. And this past week... there's a report that I'm responsible for that people are supposed to turn in, and everyone's always late. And I said that only one person had turned in something, and actually I'd forgotten that another person had also.
Okay.
And that person, you know, said to copy the email saying, you know, look, I did this. And she felt it like I'd made her look bad, even though the rest of the
got
people...
Got it. Because we're almost out of time. We need to give you something here. So, first of all, if the goddess were looking down upon you, would the goddess say that the boss's concern about you is legitimate and also that that's the real reason she's been giving you a hard time? Or would the goddess say it's not legitimate? And if it's... And should you simply do something to tweak your current job, get somebody to check your work or whatever, or just forgive yourself? What do you think really is going on if the goddess were looking down on you? And then we have to go, unfortunately. Give me a quick answer.
I think the goddess would split the difference. I think the goddess would say I was being somewhat scapegoated since I'm not the only person who's made this type of mistake. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, she'd say our department's under a microscope and something's got to be done.
Okay. So it would seem to me that I would go on a two-barreled approach. I would go to your boss and say, I can certainly understand why I'm frustrated. I've made some mistakes, but of course I haven't made that many mistakes. I've made some. But here is my plan for redoubling my effort to improve my detail-orientedness. I'm going to run by my work, by my ex-colleague or whatever, and I hope that's okay. So that would be one thing you do so you don't get fired right away. And yes, I would search broadly and seeing if I can get somewhere else, another job that would better suit your strengths and be less detail-oriented. And unfortunately, I now must say goodbye.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do more 3-minute workovers on callers, and I will give my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, a test on how to run a meeting. Plus, we'll talk about Take Your Parent to Work Day, one of the best innovations that have been sweeping corporate America. Take Your Parent to Work Day. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty Nemco's 2,000 articles are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com, that's martynemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco right here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.